Shane, you need a few seconds. Shane? Really?
Shane. Sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, give me a second. That's right.
Okay. At that point. I thought you dropped that again. Okay. To the Mediocre Movie Cast, Deadwood Edition, in which we go through a series rewind of one of the greatest TV shows ever made. I'm Creature Walking Around on Hind Legs, John Kissel, and with me tonight is the man with an invisible cocksucker next to him, Shane Settner.
Yo.
And the man who fancies Basil's bourbon hidden under the floorboards, Brian Hartman.
I understand that one again. It's two in a row.
Joining us for the first time to talk about Deadwood and seize fortune by the forelock is Bobby Schmidt.
And hello.
Shane, Bobby, and I are Deadwood repeat viewers, perching like vultures over Brian, who was our Deadwood rookie, although that position is largely ceremonial. In this episode, we'll be discussing episodes 3 and 4 of Deadwood's second season, entitled New Money and Requiem for a Gleet, as the shitty Deadwood titles rear their head once again.
What was that? Gleet?
What does gleet mean? I think we just lost Brian.
Yeah.
We seriously cannot get through an introduction. Usually like Leslie Kissel.
I'm back. What does gleet even mean?
Gleet is the stone, right?
Hang on. Let's edit that out if we can.
Nope.
Please. Please.
No.
Damn it. All right, well, your intro is already fucking made. they refer in the show as a gleet to be the kidney stones, but I looked it up, regrettably, and it's like the discharge from gonorrhea is the technical term.
Oof.
They don't ever make that mention as far as in the show, but Requiem for a Gleet, holy shit. Yes, he can hear the click of the gleet.
Oh, okay.
That's terrible title. these two episodes are defined by two things. One, new people coming into the camp, and two, Al in utter misery and near death. Well, starting with Al, his health problems from the season premiere have escalated to the point where he doesn't have any lines in these two episodes other than screaming in agony and crying out for his mother and Jesus and for it all to end.
As a resident biology major, is it like the waste backup in his body that would kill him?
I guess. I would imagine at a certain point that your blood just becomes way too salty and full of electrolytes. And also, that would cause all the water.
You to run really fast. Oh, okay. No.
Also, it would eventually get infected in there.
Gotcha.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point, too. This problem is solved eventually. Doc threatens surgery, a surgery that literally no one is excited about or into. Everyone approaches the surgery with an intense sense of dread. But at the last moment, Doc gets the great idea to just wave some smelling salts under Doc's nose or under Al's nose, and Al's informal family of Dan and Johnny and Trixie help him to just blast all this shit out of his body. I listened to the commentary by David Milch.
A subtle dripping blast.
Yeah. You could do a horse proud with the strength of that stream. I listened to the commentary on episode 3 with David Milch, the creator, and he talked about needing to remove Al at this early point in the season to allow him to be some kind of an underdog because he was very wary of Al just the shadow that Al casts over the show and wanting to put him at a disadvantage. And this is how he chose to do it. I think it was a great way to exhibit just the dreadful nature of 19th century medicine. I think we very much get that in these two episodes.
He should have gone down to Chinaman's Alley, get some ancient Chinese healing.
Sure, yeah. He would have had some needles put in his ear, and then that would have solved his kidney problems, just like that.
Yep.
Well, speaking of, I ran Trivia Night for Blair's youth group.
Okay.
One of the questions was, which one of these alternative medicines is actually backed by science? And
none of the above.
They wouldn't be alternative medicine.
One guy like, what about acupuncture? I think you're wrong. I'm like, you bring me back a report with scientific evidence, and I'll listen.
Did you write these questions?
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Creating skeptics. Tiny little skeptics.
Yeah, skeptical godfather. You're being a skeptical godfather. Yeah, it's a new skeptic godson.
Feels great.
It's very important. But Western medicine at this point was certainly no great thing either. I believe we were still in phrenology territory. Things grow by leaps and bounds.
I like how Doc described, explained how he only watched that happen.
Yeah.
And that's how he felt more comfortable in the other procedure. It's just kind of incredible that that's how they learned and how he felt comfortable doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that dread I mentioned earlier where everyone just does not want to do this, especially the doc, and then when he comes up with an alternative at the last second, just his passion and excitement for that he doesn't have to do this anymore. He becomes like some kind of like a basketball coach in the last few seconds of a close game where he's just cheering everyone on and yelling out instructions and fist pumping, and then it all just collapses into that big, beautiful pile of arms with the very soft score in the background as everyone just collapses in relief.
He actually thanks Al for not making him do it.
Yes, I would imagine it took quite a bit of effort. And we see, spoiler for the next episode, that Al actually had a little stroke while he was forcing this out of his body.
Spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler.
I think my favorite of the last scene of Ghost Coach, where just Ghost Coach just kind of floats away at the end.
Well, see, I always had a picture of Ghost Coach in my head being very calm in that moment at the end of the game. Like, he just always knew this was going to happen. He had the ultimate faith. And then, there's no emotion on his face besides just gentle satisfaction. But, that script is still in progress. So we can hash this out in our sixth draft. I believe is due in a month.
Still in its infant stages.
Back to non-inside joke reality here.
Yes, Brian, go ahead.
I think the best parts of Al's fiasco there is that him screaming draws a crowd of people looking around and stopping what they're doing, much like his last fight he got in. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference between people's reactions. And at one point, E.B., literally hides behind a pole when he's hearing Al scream. He's just a weird guy.
I think for that kind of direction, Milch had the viewer in mind, when I mentioned earlier about wanting to throw them off and get them uncomfortable. Everybody in the camp listening to Al scream, besides just the horror of his screams, that it's coming from Al makes them very uncomfortable too, because he's at the center of the camp, and if he is having these problems, what the hell are we going to do? You see that most clearly in Dan and Johnny. Dan, who is completely untethered and discombobulated.
I think Dan's my favorite part of this whole thing going on here, just how he handles it so poorly and how he reacts.
Yeah.
I think your mantra of Dan being the son of Al fits incredibly well in these two episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All four of them that collapse in the bed are upset or just exhausted for a different reason. Dan has had, dad is dying. I'm taking over the family business. I'm not ready for that shit.
Dislocates his shoulder.
Dislocates his shoulder. For Doc, it's that he doesn't want to kill another person. Trixie, it's the loss of someone you were close with, a confidant at some point, an ex-lover. And Johnny, just because he's a goddamn idiot.
Well, Johnny gets a little bit of growth, too, because at the end of that third episode, he can't stand to be in the room. He's out on the balcony hiding. But in the fourth episode, Doc tells him to leave because he assumes he's going to be the same way. But he insists that he has to stay in the room and help with the salts.
Yeah, so that's a great part.
Yeah, just very, like a throwaway line. You might miss it if you're not paying attention, but our little idiot grew a little bit this whole incident.
When Doc said milk is prick, he's like, oh, or whip his prick out. That's why he's like, nope.
Trixie, get over here. If
that was happening to me, which one of you guys would whip my prick out?
I mean, I think you're going to die of piss in your lungs at that point. Al ends the episode coming back to himself, and it couldn't come at a better time because while he's been on the sidelines, there are some interlopers coming into camp in the form of Francis Wolcott and Hugo Jari, Wolcott representing the big business interests of George Hurst, and Jari representing the territorial capital in Yankton. It's pretty obvious what Milch thinks about politicians, in that Wolcott is very much a captain of industry, or at the minimum, representing a captain of industry and all that comes with that, while Jari is revealed to be an incompetent, not incompetent, but very much a clown who is answering to Wolcott and his boss he's at their beck and call. That scene in the tub with Jari.
Titties!
I feel like that's all you need to know about that guy.
That's so good.
Yeah. Very put together and formally speaking, but in his off time, he's just a little child. Brian, you
prepared him to run Pied Piper one day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's going to be big and in horse flesh at some point in the future. Brian, you've got, and I think you mentioned it when we were talking about McCall several episodes back, that Wolcott is recast as Garrett Dillahunt.
And it drives me crazy.
I say to that, who cares?
I care. McCall has been raised from the dead or escaped jail and is now working for George Hurst in some magical fashion and is cleaned up and back.
He looks, talks, and acts so differently that it doesn't bother me in the least.
I completely agree with Bobby.
Yeah, I feel like if Wolcott and Ear Guy in this episode fucked each other, you'd actually end up with the look from McCall.
That's about right.
If their children fucked each other for like 3 or 4 generations, then maybe. Because Wolcott is about as far as you can get from McCall. I didn't even realize it first watching it until probably after after this season.
It was when I checked the cast at one point. I didn't realize my first watch through it all either.
Oh, I think this is a
Ryan.
Yeah, this is about when I got it, and it's one of those things, like, once you get it you can't get it out of your head anymore. At least I can't.
Milch, again, talks about this in his commentary.
What a big mistake it was.
No. What he said is that if the thing that he hates about this whole process the most is auditioning people. And he knew that Garrett Dillahunt is an awesome actor, so he was just like, you want to come back for the second season? He's been in TV since the early to mid-80s, and I think he has a fair amount of disdain for the average television viewer, especially since he used to work in network television. And he mentioned the commentary, like, when you watch, you know, Top Gun, you're not thinking about the guy from Risky Business all of a sudden flying fighter jets, and he complains that the same thing doesn't apply to television shows.
I think it does apply. It depends on the character. There's certain people who are typecast and can't get out of it.
You think under all that uglifying makeup that Dillahunt was under for McCall that he's been like typecast as
No, but I'm saying it happens. I'm saying it happens in both movies and TV. And to have one character or one actor play two different characters in the same show, like once you pick up on it, if you're even moderately, I don't know, if that's just something that sticks with you, you're never going to be able to get over it.
Yeah, fair enough. It's a shame because I really that you can't necessarily connect with Wolcott due to the acting thing, because I immediately find the character really interesting and well done by him. Just the way he gets over on people, and like he's looking down on them from a great height and just sizing them up and deciding how he's going to use them to his purpose. And as the harbinger of George Hurst, who the minute he says Hurst's name to anyone, it's just like a light flashes on and whoever he's talking to as to this is someone I need to treat very carefully. And Wolcott is worthy of that deference in how he carries himself. But we also see that he's a big dirtbag who is known to be quite rude to prostitutes.
He's basically in a constant position that Alma was when she's talking to EB in this episode. He's like always has the one up on everybody.
Yeah. And he hides it very well. Like I don't feel like Alma can hide her how much she dislikes EB. Like if you didn't know any better, like if you'd never seen EB before and you didn't know he was the way that EB is, it seems like Wolcott in their first meeting, they could maybe be friends. He's very friendly to EB, right, Wolcott?
Yeah.
Whereas Alma couldn't fake that on her best day.
I think where Wolcott meets his match, surprisingly, and we'll preview our, what do you call that? Our
character focus?
Not our character focus, our Cruel Masquerade is with Ellsworth. Like, yeah. Ellsworth just gives him the business, and I love it.
And like in that first conversation too, we see that Ellsworth just knows better. He knows this guy. He knows Hurst. He's revealed to have worked for Hurst before, and he knows how Hurst operates.
Which there's is no mysticism very... to Ellsworth, like on the other, like him seeing it. You know, like Hurst isn't like this super badass Ramsay Bolton villain. He knows he's just a guy who's a dick, and he knows Wolcott is the guy who's a dick.
It's in sharp contrast to Sy's conversation with Wolcott, and I just like how far apart they are, considering the characters normally.
Yeah. And Wolcott, who's been in camp, he's in camp for like a half an hour, and then he immediately just gets to work doing Hurst's bidding, which is to spread rumors throughout the camp that all their gold claims are going to be invalidated as the camp gets absorbed into the United States, but tricking people into selling their holdings to Sy, who Wolcott captures, and then those holdings being sold back to Wolcott and Hurst. And he finds two very, very different marks in Sy and EB. We're going to talk more about EB a little later, but the way that Wolcott just breaks EB down completely to where he's begging on his knees at the side of Wolcott's table. Fantastic. It's a great introduction
episode. I think there's basically this is our intro into most of the rest of the things that I think we need to talk about besides Maddie, Joni, and the Bullocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of my quotes revolve around this, our character focus, our Cruel Masquerade. This is just the new thing in town that's going to take over the story real quick.
Yeah. What minutes that Al would have gotten in the story are given to EB, or a lot of them are given to EB, and, you know, who can complain about that?
This is a great stroke to say, here's what the town works like without the most stable factor involved.
Yeah. And you see how quickly it can be taken away from Al, too. Like, he has a concrete hold on everyone, but it's not that concrete. if he's out of the picture for any brief period of time. And like these episodes take place over 2 days. So 2 days without Al means that his ally can be corrupted completely and a new force in the camp can be pretty well established. So despite the force of Al's personality, it is still the Wild West. Anything can happen. Brian, you mentioned Maddie and Joni. Maddie, played by Alice Krieg, continues to be awesome, even though her character is a little less so. She reveals her purpose for coming to the camp was to follow Wolcott, who she's worked with before, because she knows that he's rough with prostitutes and has a habit of that. And her plan is to get him angry enough to where he does it. And then she would blackmail him and stop whoring and prostituting. And Joni is displeased with that and tries to sabotage it a little bit, even though they're business partners. And she would be in for half of whatever Wolcott pays her. But Joni didn't necessarily get out from under Psy to go back into having people murdered for money.
Is it so much that she's against Maddie's plan, or just really despises how Wolcott comes across?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like Maddie has that line about, or that series of lines about how Joni seems to be upset that a great man like George Hurst would employ people like Wolcott, who beat the shit out of women,
right?
And worse. And Joni's being like, all that Joni's really seen of the world has been through Psy. So I think potentially a way that Joni's got through all that is to imagine that there are better people somewhere, potentially in big business, potentially captains of industry that people write stories about. And to find out that that's not true, yeah, I would imagine is quite disheartening. And for her mentor in a lot of ways too, and Maddie, to be corrupt as well. It's just disabusing Joni of a lot of illusions that she probably shouldn't have in Deadwood, but nonetheless.
I have a hard time getting vested in Joni's story at this point. Like, I just really didn't care that much compared to everything else going on.
So
I'm actually with you, Brian. Like, she's never been a very appealing character to me.
Gosh, I feel the complete opposite about that. I'm so sympathetic to Joni, and I love that actress. I feel like she was robbed of a supporting actress Oscar for Gone Girl a couple of years ago. Kim Dickens, she just does great work.
She's fighting zombies.
And I don't watch that show. I watched one episode of Fear the Walking Dead and just couldn't do it anymore.
She had a solid run in Lost, too, Kizzle.
Oh, did she? Mm-hmm. She was in the shitty season of Friday Night Lights, too. She was a non-shitty part about it.
You all are naming all the shows I don't watch and have no plan on watching. Well, so I have no emotional connection to her.
You should watch Friday Night Lights. Exactly. It's an easy watch, but just skip season two. It's season two that was awful, right? Or the three?
Yes.
That's the one with, like, 24-year-old models playing high school cheerleaders, right?
It's not as bad.
I think that was an actor.
All that.
That's most of high school television, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah. It's a good chunk of it.
You can get over it pretty quickly because Milo, Mila, or whatever the hell her name is easy on the eyes.
I've never watched it, and I don't plan to at all.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It's a solid show. Here and there. Away from Wolcott, we've also got Alma being a little pissed off that her relationship with Bullock has ended and taking it out on EB and her tutor, Miss Isringhausen, who... in turn, after being fired by Alma, goes to Silas Adams and confides in him that maybe Alma's a murderer. I mean, we know what's happening here. I don't know that Brian... I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know what's about to happen.
You're with her. Yeah, she's a little shady. She's born a little shady.
But that was really surprising to find out that she is lying about who she is and what she does.
What's the heiress's name?
Sarah Paulson, another awesome.
She's fantastic.
Yeah,
she just nails it. Like, she's so buttoned up that you just don't expect it.
Yeah, more so than Alma, who was already, pretty buttoned up in most of the time. when she's not around Bullock. Do you get the feeling
that she dresses Miss Isringhausen down a little bit more simply because that's probably how she was raised and she resents that part?
I think there's a little bit of E.B. and Richardson in their dynamic where Alma just feels the need to take out her bad temper on an inferior. Alma's clearly not a good tutor for Sophia, giving her candy all the time. But Miss Isringhausen, solid character. And Alma talking shit to E.B., fantastic. And we'll come back to that too. Brian, that's your scene of the week.
Yep, that's definitely up there. So
we'll talk about that a little later. Last thing is Bullock. He has his family is settling in.
Since you can't see me, I'm rolling my eyes right now.
I figured,
just so everyone knows. My gosh.
I was going to throw to you, Brian. Now is your Bullock shit talking time.
Okay.
Before you do that, let's pause for your official Bullock bully music. And here it goes. Grab your blocks when you see Tupac. Call the cops when you see Tupac. Who shot me? But your pumps
didn't finish. Now you're about to feel the wrath of a menace. Nigga, I hit him up. Okay, great. Here I am. So two things that really just rubbed me the wrong way. They talk about this majestic stream in the front of their house that's like a foot wide and probably 6 inches deep.
Whatever. There's a big fish in there.
Yeah. It's big enough. And they talk about how they're going to go catch this fish. You want to catch the fish? You put your hands in the damn stream and just pull the thing out of there. It's 6 inches deep. It's not a crisis to get that fish out like everyone's making it out to be. And Bullock's talking to his son. I don't remember the kid's name.
His nephew, son.
Right. Nephew son. That's his nephew son. And he says, do you recall your way to the hardware store? The hardware store, you can probably throw a rock and hit the hardware store from the front door.
There's no law in this town.
You have to throw over that huge creek.
Yeah.
He's got to make sure William's got his waders on so he can get across there.
Go across.
William, are you going to ford the river?
The 2x4 he lives.
It's an Oregon Trail situation.
Oh, down their house on the western slope. I've just
never ford the river.
Bullock's a free range parent. You send your kid out with a handful of oatmeal to your Old West hardware store and just trust that he'll get there fine.
Yep, all 75 yards of it.
Yeah.
And we get a good shot of... Oh, wait, are we still bullying Bullock?
If you
Bullocks,
feel you
yes.
have to.
Bully the Bullocks all you want.
Well, I was saying, we get a good shot of Anna Gunn with the pretty quiet, like, after William leaves, she does a little sigh because he's going out into the town by himself. You can tell she's uncomfortable with it, but she's not going to say anything.
I kind of interpreted that as like, holy shit, I'm losing my buffer. Without William here, it's going to be that much harder to talk to Seth.
Yeah, I thought that was more about Bullock than it was the kid.
Oh, really? See, I took like two or three, I don't know when before that, but when at one point she like smirkingly smiled at something that Bullock said. It was like the first Bullock emotion other than disgruntledness that we've seen out of any of the three of them.
Milch talks about part of Deadwood being about a man learning to love his wife. This is what he's referring to. They're about as far away from it right now as they could be. They're like work acquaintances at best.
So am I understanding this that they're like setting themselves up to have sex or just talk? Like, I had a hard time understanding what in the world they're talking about.
I do think in that scene they're talking about having a conversation just because they seem so far away from consummating this marriage at this point.
I think it's more about comfort and being able to just communicate, which of course for a viewer there's also going to be, I guess, some tension level with the sexual frustration or tension thrown in there just by the way it's filmed. But I think it's all more about comfort and communication at first.
I completely disagree. They're definitely talking about having sex.
Really? Yes.
Hear the word intercourse, Shane, and not any of its other synonyms.
Well, they are definitely talking about having sex. You guys are crazy. not only is the conversation alluding to it, I think, and being cute, but she also just says intercourse. And she asks,
intercourse can mean a lot of things, Shane. It was like 140 years ago.
The meaning of the 1800s version of intercourse.
Yeah, I'm with you, like, Shane. The smirky, she's not smirky smiling over having a conversation.
I think she is, though.
No, you're crazy.
I can see an argument for them having sex just because the scene cuts away.
Why would she have him shut the door?
Because they didn't want to wake their kid up over their conversation.
He sleeps soundly.
Does Milch not comment on one of the four commentaries you've watched and read about this, John?
He comments at some point in the future.
Don't ruin it.
Well, you would never guess the scene because I had to watch the scene several times to realize what was actually happening.
Well, don't tell me if it's in the future.
I won't. It's past where you watched.
I think audiences are dumb. That's why I put the word intercourse in there. Fuck. I'm gonna take a Joe Sinner bold stance on this. That's it.
Bold stance. Bullock and his wife had sex.
Bold stance. Actually, you guys are making the bold stance. Damn it!
They just seem they can't even talk to each other.
Yeah, they're trying to solve their issues through intercourse.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. They're trying to solve their issues through intercourse. We're saying the exact same thing, Brian. But words have meanings. do we got anything else about events from these two episodes before we move on to future scenes?
My wife.
I got a couple.
Go for it.
I like to mention the fun history snippets, and they have a great scene that we get to with our Cruel Masquerade, actually, where they show sort of the history of mining and what that looked like back then. That's kind of neat to see. And ear guy that gets killed by Johnny, he is super gross. Not Johnny. I always get those two mixed up.
Johnny wouldn't hurt a fly.
What's his name? Dan. Yeah.
Dan killed him.
Dan kills ear guy. Ear guy is one of the most disgusting characters I've ever seen.
Okay, with that, so was Jack McCall, and that's why Wolcott's so different. Like, I read that on your notes, and that's what I thought about.
Yeah,
like,
Crop Ear and Wolcott have nothing in common with each other. They couldn't even carry on a conversation.
Right, and that's why I don't understand how you don't separate McCall from Wolcott, but we're past that, so go ahead.
That's on that history snippet, in the Deadwood book, buy the Deadwood book, Amazon.com.
No, not Amazon, MediocreMovie.com.
Click on our link, the Mediocre Movie book, and then go to Amazon.com to buy the Deadwood book, Tales of the Black Hills. Talking about gold mining in general, I like the symbolic impact, meaning of gold mining. He has a very low opinion of it, let's just say that. But I mean, you remember the scenes with Ellsworth just panning in the creek and like this idol of nature, and now it's all been torn up, and there's like a lone, sad pine tree just waiting to go next. I mean, that's just what progress looks like here. You root shit up and you take shit out of the ground and leave it, you know.
I didn't even think about that because I would have thought that it's not necessarily in the same location. Because a claim is probably acres and acres.
Well, I mean, her claim was where Brom died. And that was also a wooded area with a waterfall.
Right, but how many acres is that?
Oh, well, who knows? Who knows?
Well, right. We only really saw the border between Ellsworth and her claim for most
of
that
time. Yes, that's true. Yeah. That is true. But just like all this wilderness that was holy to the Indians is now, you know. It's just
a loud machine.
Loud machines pulling rocks out of the ground. Sad commentary. But we're going to go on to scenes of the week. I'll kick us off here. We mentioned Ellsworth just being generally awesome already, and we'll continue on with that in Cruel Masquerade. But him, he gets a long monologue comforting Alma. There's just a lot of good, solid economic rules in there. When like a nice Warren Buffettism, when others are fearful, be greedy. Counseling her in the wake of all these Wolcott planted rumors to just stay fast. This is all bullshit. Let's just wait this out. And if anything, you'll have more money at the end. And just the way that Milch writes him, I don't have the line in front of me exactly, but where God created gold, there also he made sure to plant a rumor, although the opposite wouldn't prove to be just as true. It's a great line. Nice little bit of wisdom there. And just their relationship, their working relationship, as it progresses, it's just really warm and buck her up. And it just demonstrates that the dumb people will be the ones that are taken advantage of by Wolcott. Another line he throws in there about fear being easier on the back than the shovel. Like a lot of these miners, I would imagine, came here with a very specific image of their future in their head, and after several months of really hard work for not a lot of money and probably not a lot to show for it after spending money in the gym or the Bell Union or Tom Nuttall's or wherever, are looking for an excuse to go. And I think Hurst and Wolcott understand that, and I think Ellsworth understands that too. And so just to see this scene play out, highlight of the week.
I agree. That is a fantastic scene. Milch just writes Ellsworth's dialogue so well all three seasons.
He's a big fan of Ellsworth, no question. He's a truth teller. Desperately needed in this time and place. Brian, you got your scene on the Google Doc.
Yeah, because Ellsworth...
in the same spot.
Alma is in there as well. Yeah.
Is fucked up.
So this is when Alma is lashing out against EB and his rumors. This might be my favorite scene so far in the whole shebang here. So I'm going to quote Alma here if somebody wants to play EB right afterwards. He's got the impersonation here.
Yeah, go for it.
All right, Shane's got it. So Alma offering to buy EB's hotel if the town is falling apart. She says, "How do you males put it? Shit or get off the chamber pot?"
Oh, Mrs. Garrett. Shit indeed. Oh, dear.
And then you've also got to stand up and bash your head into the just for an added intensity.
Oh, dear.
Oh, I thought that was great.
Yeah, that's a fantastic scene also.
This is along with my thing, like when people use words like probably, or it's going to happen, or like sidebar that John won't understand in our nerdy. A guy says that Jose Bautista is going to get punched again, and so I offered him a bet. Like, do you really think this is going to happen? $5 says it doesn't, and all of a sudden he backs down. I mean, this is putting your money where your mouth is pretty quick, and I love it.
Yeah, I just think it's cool that you've brought in actors from Guardians of the Galaxy into your baseball league. I assume that's the same person.
Speaking of, let's give a quick update on our fantasy baseball team. Brian and I had our first defeat last week, unfortunately.
Oh, it was devastating.
Yeah, we just didn't bring it. The other guy had a good week. John, what do you think?
I'm going to stop being courteous and gently putting my glasses down when I take a
sip. I have a trade offer for Shane in one of our dirty baseball leagues, though.
What do you got? Which league?
I was looking at a couple Royals prospects, like Miguel Almonte, Jorge Bonifacio, and a pick or something.
Okay. Well, Almonte might be on the table. I'm not sure about Bonifacio, but we'll see what we can do. Kissel, do you have any opinions on those guys?
You're all idiots. You're all dumb as shit. Anyways, we're going to talk about EB and our character focus, but similar to his scene with Wolcott, you just see him start from the closest thing to confidence that EB can muster up to complete and utter destruction at the hand of the person he thought he had control of. Where he just walks up and he's like, "Oh, you're dumb, but you have intuition, like all women. I know this to be fact, and I'm going to say it as such." And then by the end, he's just hunched over and sitting down and completely made a fool of.
He admits it. He says out loud, you know, calls her a cunt and says how, you know, she's brought out the worst in him or whatever he said at that point, but basically just admitted out loud that she got the best of him.
a worthy linger for the director of the episode. And you can't ever really see Farnham shit on enough. That's always a great scene. Comedy genius Bill Sanderson handles that well. Yeah, a reasonable favorite scene of the series so far, I think.
And the best part is that I remembered a scene of the week without saying, oh, man.
No, you did good. Yeah.
Yep, thanks.
Shane?
We actually haven't even talked about Jane at all today. So my favorite scene of the week, well, I mean, not my favorite, but the scene I want to talk about the most is between her and Trixie. Like, she outdrunks a drunk. The discomfort on Jane's face the entire time Trixie is talking kills me.
She gets to see how she makes people feel in 90% of her walking about life.
It totally reminds me of when my brother outbummed a bum. He passed out on a, you know, Joe's like 6 foot. He passes out in Chicago on like this 3 foot bench that's like 2 feet wide. And some bum came up to him and was like, hey man, you okay? Oh man, that ain't right. That ain't right. And it's like a bum who's like wearing dirty sweaters and everything. I'm just like, that's all I could think about that entire scene. Like Jane's like, fuck this.
And he never recovered, and now you can find him on a street corner in Chicago just relying on the kindness of strangers,
just taking bold stances and getting paid for it. Flip me some of that spare change or your old deep crust pizza, man. I'll give you a bold stance. I think the Lake Michigan is made out of gold.
Worth a nickel at least. I mean, you know, be fair. Bobby, what do you got? Scene of the week.
Nobody told me I was supposed to prepare scene of the week, but I'll jump in and say Dan's, when he kills Krusty or whatever his name was, that whole scene, because it shows him trying to handle something and kind of take the initiative to check on Al's progress and how it just goes wrong because Dan can't handle it and he's so irritable at that moment. That just the slightest little talk back, you know, caused him to slit his throat. And I just, Dan's part in this episode in general is one of my favorite things, like I said before.
Fundamentally incapable of doing what Al does. All of Al's lessons have gone for naught. If Al was as hot-tempered as Dan, like, no one would ever walk out of his office. Except wrapped up in a rug.
But I love how, like, Dan still talks to him as he's walking down the stairs, and when he sits at the table, he's still yelling up at the guy.
Yeah, you made me do Dan. This.
Right.
You don't know what I've been through today.
Like, I was trying to do you a favor, and you fucked it up, now you're dead.
As pathetic as Dan, Dan does a lot of crying in these episodes, but he's the actor, W. Earl Brown, who is worth pointing out, played Mary's disabled brother, and there's something about Mary that blew my mind.
Yeah, I saw that last night. Yeah. I was dumbfounded.
Yeah, who'd have thunk it? But he brings out the physical comedy with his shoulder, where he's just dragging it and like pulling it up and dropping it on the bar, and then by the end of episode 4, he's like surprised that it's working again. There's very much stuff in the background, but it like I didn't realize that it was Dan screaming out for the love of God in the gym as EB is trying to. I thought that was Al. I thought that was like Doc examining Al. But it makes it was Dan getting his shoulder set. I can't believe I missed that. Yeah. But his shriek of pain versus Al's shriek of pain. One is just like blood curdling, and the other is hilarious.
I don't know, so I know why that is top notch again.
Absolutely.
But he eventually understood Wu. when he right before he leaves, he's like, tall San Francisco cocksucker looks like you, got it. But like he still didn't understand that he understood it.
Yeah, he was spot on. It was actually pretty quick compared to what we saw with Al.
He just doesn't have any respect for Wu, so he doesn't treat what he's saying seriously. Like Al would say, okay, now we're going to go look for this San Francisco cocksucker who's taller than you. But Al just thinks Wu. I don't think Dan thinks he's smart enough to really understand it in the first place and therefore act on it. And second of all, I don't think he gives a shit what Wu has to say. as good at interpreting sign language as Dan reveals himself to be. Sign language is being generous. wild gesticulations. And
there you go.
Interspersed with cocksucker. We're going to talk about our favorite Old West innkeeper next in Eustace Bailey Farnham. These two episodes, again, a great showcase for him on multiple occasions. We see him at his most confident and at his least confident. What passes for a big moment for NEB's mind, and groveling at the side of someone's table and complimenting them obsequiously. And he just plays the whole range. Richardson is coming in more and more in the show, and that gives EB and Bill Sanderson more and more time to monologue. And he's absolutely one of the best characters on the show. Top five, I'd say. Especially in this early going, he gets a little lost later in the series. But when he's still heavy on screen, just every word that comes out of his mouth, and every action, like when he's leaving the gym early in episode 3, and Dan like gives him like a royal farewell, like he was a king or something, and Evie just turns around and swats his hands at him for some reason. I choose to believe that was improvised, just because who would think of that? He's just so much fun to watch.
I think, I've got a couple quotes from him this week. He's always got something to say. Like, he's much like an eighth grade student who they say something like, "This is an awkward silence." And I say, "No, this is peaceful silence. EB cannot handle peaceful silence." He's always got to have something to say.
Milch talks about EB and he talks about Jerry in the same way, too. Hugo Jerry, the county commissioner. He talks about both of them having little men on their shoulders who's just always whispering in their ear, "Okay, you explained that pretty well, but just make sure that they understand." And then they say something unnecessary, and then the little man was like, "That was pretty good. You know, you got to really make sure this is really important." And then he just keeps saying something.
Don't stop now, EB. Keep going.
Yeah, and I've got several quotes from EB, and we'll be portraying him in our Cruel Masquerade. But I mean, I feel like I have to spoil it a little bit, just the way that after EB gives Wolcott the Hickok letter, and Wolcott, just like his intrigue immediately turns to disgust, like it's damp. Just reading this letter has been sitting next to EB's armpit, yeah, potentially for months.
These damp palms, Al.
He's a great character.
Yeah, like he makes. I mean, he doesn't make the show, but he's just the perfect. I don't know if you want to call it screech of the show, because that's demeaning. But he is just a grotesque creature.
So anytime someone needs to feel better about themselves, put them in a scene with EB, and he'll just boost their confidence, no problem. Like Alma was feeling down.
Except for Richardson.
Except for everyone. Yes, that applies to everybody except Richardson, who is a fantastic foil for EB.
So after a season and a third, you said he's a top five character. I'm trying to think so far, who other than Al? Like, Al's number one in my book.
Of course.
And I assume everyone else's are... Who beats EB for number two?
Oh, man. Doc.
I'll rattle some off. Yeah, I got
Doc would give him a run. I think
Ellsworth is up there.
I've got them all as, like, 2A, B, and C in terms of enjoying the scenes that they're in.
Bullock, of course.
No, Bullock is not in the top 10.
I would say my top five at this point would have to be Al, Bullock, Jane, and then Johnny and Dan.
That's a lot of respect for Bullock.
I'd get Joni and Wild Bill in there. I'd get Joni and Wild Bill in mine.
Wild Bill's been dead a while.
I know, but first season and a third.
I think, I don't know. I don't know if Wild Bill had enough time for me to really latch on.
Nah.
That guy works for me.
This is a hard exercise. Because now I'm
like, it is very much a hard emphasis. I'm sorry I brought it up.
I'm glad you brought it up. See, I think EB adds a comedy aspect that only maybe Johnny is adding otherwise.
I mean, I think literally every actor has the opportunity to get in a good line now and then. The show is definitely not lacking for comic relief.
But he's the lead in terms of no one's rooting for him at this point, but he doesn't make you squirm in how bad he is.
But he's not very dynamic in the least. Like, you know what you're getting every time he's on screen for the most part, which is fine because it's great. But character-wise, he just doesn't match up to some of the others, I think.
I think this is where they're turning, and like him, EB talking to Richardson. Like, EB has always been so downtrodden. And like watching him try to play, someone with a puffier chest talking down to Richardson, it's almost comedic compared to people talking to EB.
And you like EB. EB's in my top five now.
Yes.
I gotta drop Johnny out.
And EB thinks he has like complete respect from Richardson, I think, when that is obviously not the case. Richardson just ignores him and smells kidneys while EB's trying to unburden himself.
I laughed a lot when he said I wasn't listening.
Yes, that's one of my quotes of the week right there.
I was smelling this meat, leave me the fuck alone. The Grand Central staff, yeah, they don't lack for some of the best in the show, definitely. anything else? Anything else we want to add on EB before moving on to our favorite lines?
I'm good.
All right,
he's top five, top three,
top five is
Brian's top five now.
I do agree with Bobby that I wish there was more to him than just the comic relief. I mean, very much what you see is what you get in, like, the first episode of Deadwood. He is more or less the same character. But, yeah, like Bobby said again, and I guess I'm just repeating Bobby's point, but I wholeheartedly co-sign to it. Because he does what he does very, very well.
Guess can't get enough. If you remember old fraternity meetings, when we used to say, if you agree with someone, just say, I agree with them, and stop there. Do not listen to EB on your shoulder. Keep explaining it, John.
He's just so persuasive. It's hard to say no to Lil EB. Lil EB.
We should sell those on our website, Lil EBs.
The name of my next kid will be something with the initials.
How about Lil EB?
Lil EB.
I feel like I need to do EB's voice like Shane's been doing it now in the Cool Masquerade.
Yeah, Shane's been practicing a lot, I think.
Clock's ticking. You got to get that down to a science.
Let's hear a practice.
Next 5 or 10
minutes. No, we're just going to wing it. It'll be much better.
All right. That's what we like in Cool Masquerade.
Unpracticed and mediocre.
I'm just going to exaggerate what Shane's trying to do, and it'll be much worse.
Favorite lines from these two episodes. We're missing Al, so that's a big blow to the best line generator in the show. But we're certainly not lacking for good writing here, for good dialogue. I'll kick us off with Saul still pretty loosened up. I got a couple from him this week, but the first is responding to Bullock talking about the camp potentially being screwed. Even in an Eden like this, wrongs sometimes occur. Just sarcastic, wounded shopkeeper. We love you, Saul.
I'll go next with the EB conversations around it. Do you understand me, Richardson? No.
Shane, you're cutting out.
Oh, okay, yeah, I heard you guys cut out too. We'll try again. Do you understand me, Richardson? No. It's more for a Richardson line, it's so good.
Sure. You gotta really drag out that no. No. There's like five syllables in that no.
No. Ooh, that was good.
Brian?
I'm just gonna practice my Richardson real quick. Bobby already stole my line, but he says, I wasn't listening.
And it makes Evie so angry. It doesn't faze Richardson in the least.
I love how Richardson runs off after that conversation.
Oh, he's just out. He's like, you got the rest of the night off. He's like, okay.
The way he skedaddles to the door.
So good.
Bobby, did you record any?
I have no line of the week.
Okay. If anything, well, we have several apiece. Right. So you've got, you've got plenty of time in the next few minutes if you come up with any.
I'll just listen to yours.
Okay. I'm going a little darker for the next one. Doc is very frustrated with Trixie and her disapproval at his methods, giving her a little taste of truth. What shall I say to you, Trixie, that I'm sure of a happy outcome for Al and every one of us? Man doesn't fuck around.
It's good, Doc.
Good, Doc.
Pretty easy one from Joni Stubbs, actually. Nuts!
The commentary got very strange for that scene. Milch was molested as a kid, in addition to being a drug addict for a certain period of time and a gambling addict. Guy's lived a very long life. But he talked about how, big sidebar here, he talked about how we know that Joni has been molested as a child, and he asserts in the commentary that Wolcott has too, and Wolcott's like sexual problems of not wanting to be touched and just having very specific instructions for Joni once they go into the back room. That all comes from recreating his molestation incident when he was a kid, and Joni does the same thing. Like, she sees things escalating between Wolcott and Maddie, and her instinct is to use her sexuality to defuse the situation, and she does exactly that. It was very interesting commentary from a very dark place. Buy those Deadwood DVDs. You get fun tidbits.
That really does reflect that whole scene, just the uncomfortableness watching it, but then watching, I guess, Joni just so comfortable with it, and Wolcott does not embrace it at all.
Like, Milch talked about Joni appearing to be so comfortable, but he also talked about when getting into that state, you just leave your body. You understand what you're supposed to say while you are not really saying it. You're just reenacting a script. That is a strange scene, but there's just so much backstory to every scene in the show. Apparently, what Milch likes to do on set is talk about Faulkner or William James or some novelist or some abstract theory for 30 minutes before continuing with the scene that is about Seth getting back into the store. Just what appears to be a very simple scene. And that's a big part of why Deadwood has so many financial problems, is because like productions just ran over and over and over because Milch is not a speedy writer. Kind of just happened in the moment. He's the most interesting person in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
we can tell. All
right, I'm a fan.
Are you gonna write the unofficial biography?
Holy shit! No. Go ahead, Brian. What's your next line?
I'll stay off of the comedy train for a little second. Well, actually, it's not bad. New McCall, when he's just meets Cy. And Cy's going to bring his lackeys over. He looks at him and he just says, I don't want to meet them.
I think you're still on the comedy train.
I can't get off it.
That's a great line. That's
a great line.
Con and Leon have turned into such a useless pair of clowns by this early point in the series. That he's, yeah. It's easy to put yourself in McCall's shoes. Keep those jackasses as far away from you as possible. I got another Saul quote. One of his truisms: if money had to be clean before it was recirculated, we'd still be living in fucking caves.
I loved that one.
This is brilliant. The best thing that ever happened to Saul was getting shot in the shoulder.
Getting loaded up with drugs.
Absolutely. Let that be a lesson to all you kids out there.
Go get shot.
Go get shot and filled up with opium from the 19th century, and you'll be all set.
I got one a line with quips I liked.
Nonstop.
Yeah, I got a line I liked. It was when Wolcott first walks in, and Cy, when he orders the whiskey from Kentucky or the bourbon from Kentucky, and Cy just like give him a bourbon and tell him it's from Kentucky, and like I just wonder how different that would have been if he would have known he was from Hearst, because like that line stood out to me, especially after Cy's attitude completely changed.
Yeah, like it's not in Cy to like kneel at Walcott's table and beg forgiveness, but it's not so far away. Like the change that goes over Cy when Wolcott tells who he's from. Like if he didn't have the drink that Wolcott wanted, I don't know. I feel like he would have beat the shit out of somebody off hours.
Right.
Shane?
Oh, my phone clicked off. Hang on.
There we go. Ryan?
It's good pot.
Yeah, I've got... Yeah, go ahead, Shane.
This quick recovery. Tiny corner of an operation for such an amusing mind in the same scene as earlier. Showing some respect to Joni.
He's got a nice turn of phrase, Wolcott. He's a smart motherfucker.
Brian? I've got EB real early in episode 3. As Bullock walks by, he just says, "The camp pugilist."
Anytime someone walks by, he's got to say something.
Exactly.
Allman Ellsworth safely returned. Can't help himself. My last one from Adams to Miss Isringhausen, who's pretending to be someone who's never had a drink before. If that's your first taste of liquor, sorry for the hand you've been playing your whole life. Amen, brother.
Reach.
Shane, any more?
We got EB. Miserable, haughty cunt, putting me beyond my depth. With Alma. Love that one.
Brian?
I've got EB as part of his conversation with Richardson. We're going back to, he's basically yelling at this point, destitution looms! Richardson says, oh dear.
This is after a very long sequence of EB trying to be clever until he just has to grab Richardson by his shirt and tell him exactly what to say to people.
Well, Brian and I share the last one, so let's say it together. Okay, you ready? One, two, three. So below
entails cutting through his taint.
Seamless.
That would, for reference, that would be after Doc described surgery of either going above the bladder or below. Johnny chimes in.
I once
they didn't call it a gooch in Deadwood. They went with the local colloquialism of taint. Who'd have thunk it?
Well, I once had a buddy who had a bachelor party out in the woods of Kentucky, and he came back with a tick on his taint.
Oh, dear.
I believe it got to the size of a nickel.
Oh, God.
Is that so total sidebar here. What did you just call it besides a taint?
I've heard of it.
I've never heard that one. I've heard of a chode before.
Chode.
Oh, that's
okay.
Right.
Now there's that's three now.
Tana's chode.
Like specific. We could divide the country this way.
It will be on the next New York Times. Where do you get your pronunciations from?
Is it so we'll get to add to the next census.
I'd like to know where to go
and have the census worker like point to it because it's really hard to explain to. What do you call this area right here? And then hundreds of census workers.
So speaking of language, this is the episodes where EB and Wolcott, they kind of poke fun at the show's use of obscenity, right? This is that one, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, where he's like, do they use that kind of language? And it was kind of a reflective of the whole show in large and how they use the same vulgar words that we use these days, just so I guess we relate. Because that's not what they would have said back then.
That's something Milch does in like every interview and article I read from this period of time about him, which is not a small amount. it's just apologizing for the language in his own. Well, not apologizing. I mean, he's right to do it, but if you had everybody saying concern it and darnation, it just wouldn't work. So let's go with the fucks and the douchebags, although I would imagine douchebags did not exist in this period of time.
So I've got a new segment for us.
Oh boy.
So 2 weeks ago, I'm sitting in church and listening to the sermon, and it was, John something. And I thought to myself, wow, that sounds just like Deadwood. So we're going to play Deadwood or the Bible.
Okay.
So here we go. Here's the quote here. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish.
Bible.
I'll just go with Deadwood to be different.
It is John chapter 11, verse 50.
Damn.
The NIV. I thought definitely the gist of that sentiment is going to come up in Deadwood at some point.
I know. That's why I picked it out. I'm going to keep bringing it. It'll... added a segment here. Deadwood or the Bible?
That was our first round of Deadwood or the Bible. Stay tuned next week for the continuation of Deadwood or the Bible. We're going to continue
sponsored
on.
Sponsored by Benzene Lager.
Do they still have a slogan?
Yeah, we'll see. Fingers crossed.
We'll get you the justice you deserve. We'll get you the justice you need. And the money you deserve.
Ah, you're getting justice and money. That's about it.
Hey, we're gonna
charge on through with a cruel masquerade because we've got four with us, and there wasn't a good four-person scene that satisfied one of our ranks' rules about language. We split it up into two-person scenes this week. We're going to start with Bobby as EB and Shane as Wolcott in a scene in which EB opens up his scam on Wolcott for the Hickok letter. So Bobby's going to start us off whenever you're ready. Get that voice all cranked up and ready to go. Impersonation, that is.
Mr. Wolcott, I'm the custodian, note I do not say owner, of Wild Bill Hitchcock's final earthly communication.
It's damp.
Mr. Wolcott, not an hour before giving me this letter, Bill confided in me, having come up upon a quartz deposit promising in bills on words, wealth beyond counting. How much wealth is that? I don't know, Mr. Wolcott. I don't know how high Bill could count.
How much do you want me to pay?
I hardly expect you to pay anything. Imagining rather that I will pay you your cost to see the letter delivered to its proper recipient, plus $100 set against whatever profit you may generate, should delivery prove impossible, from the information the letter contains.
So, this offsets against profits I might gain from the event that this letter, proving undeliverable, contains such valuable information. Have you an amount in mind?
$10,000.
Less than $100 you would pay me. Are you guys still there?
I'm correct. Still here.
He said it.
Bobby?
No, he said it. We were talking over him. Continue, please.
$9,900 net then. Me to you.
Yes. Yes.
And I would pay you. And I will pay you that now before attempting the letter's delivery.
Oh, yes. Once you have the letter, all my connection is severed.
I see.
To deliver or not, or whatever the hell you want to do.
Well, you will have my decision shortly.
Fine, then.
For the luggage.
Oh, no, I wouldn't hear of it. It was my great pleasure. I trust I'll hear from you soon.
Was that a Bitcoin for the luggage that you pulled out?
Wolcott's like, oh, excuse me, I'm getting a call. Mr. Hurst, get the fuck out.
Well, my laundry's done, just so everyone knows.
It's a little more charming than your dishwasher.
That was extra cruel. For the masquerade. Great. Great.
Didn't EP realize I was doing Wolcott tonight. I should have paid more attention.
Horrible EB, but that's all right.
I mean, you know, solid EB. We're going to continue on in our next scene with Brian as Wolcott and myself as Ellsworth. It's going to be the scene where they have a confrontation at the Garrett Mine, and Brian's going to start us off.
Hello.
What's your business?
I'm Francis Wolcott.
My name's Ellsworth, Mr. Francis Wolcott. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How do you do?
I'm well. Glad you make me out.
Yes, sir.
Because them as poke around Ms. Garrett's workings without a by your leave ain't welcome, Mr. Wolcott. And you ought not to repeat your fucking mistake.
Well, that's an uncivil response to an innocent error.
Did you work in the Comstock when you was beardless?
I did.
For Mr. George Hurst, as a keen eye for the color?
As a geologist for Mr. Hurst? Well, you have the advantage of me, Mr. Ellsworth.
That ain't a possibility, Wolcott. No more than an error of yours would be innocent.
I do dimly recall an Ellsworth superintended the Consolidated Virginia operations.
I don't give a fuck what you recall.
A hero dug for a week without respite to save three poor souls from a cave-in.
46 corpses in a fucking hole that ought never to have been dug.
Always a choice to count the saved or lost.
Get off this property.
Just as a man opposed to inevitable change needn't invariably be called a Luddite, another choice might simply to describe him as slow in his processes.
You tell that cocksucker you work for, the next surrogate he sends oughtn't to be blooded from the Comstock.
The noise is terrible, isn't it, Mr. Ellsworth? Like fate.
All right. No dryer alarms in that one. Okay, closing thoughts on these two episodes? Anything left to say?
Just a couple of pretty solid episodes. I don't think they're A+. I think B+, A-ish on both these for me.
Too much of the Bullocks to get above an A- for me.
Okay. I'm probably borderline A-A. Like, I haven't been watching continuously here with you guys, so I kind of jumped back into these two without watching. You know,
they're pretty much standalone.
Right, and they do. And that's what I liked about it is I was glad these two when I started watching because they stood alone, so they were strong for me. So A-A.
I'd probably go with Bobby, A-A. All the stuff with Dan in the second episode and the introduction of Jerry really elevates the second episode above the first.
Especially, I think what helps it is that it's still so strong without Al that I just couldn't give it a lower grade. Like, to be as good as it was without Al being there stands out.
And the arc of that first episode is so negative as far as Al's progress. Like, you start with him in a pretty bad place, and then you end with him with a long metal pole up his dick. Whereas he's more or less, he's fine, essentially, kind of. He's getting there at least at the end of the fourth episode. You can just kind of exhale a little bit.
The final shot, just to him in his bed, say nothing.
Yeah.
You're right. It's well, A-.
And as you said before, John, is like, I'm not sure what I was going to say when Shane talked. But with Al, it's important to the show in general because it shows Al's weakness for a moment. And I think that's just important. So it raises it a little bit.
Yeah. He'll be playing catch up the rest of the season. Justifiably so. I mean, he passed a whole bunch of gleets, whatever the fuck that is, out of himself.
So what we're getting out of this is Ramsey Bolton needs a bladder stone.
Sure, among other things. I mean, Doc should just do an exploratory taint operation on Ramsey Bolton if we can just mix these worlds together, just to see, just to make sure. I mean, better safe than sorry.
All right, I got a quick first thing that comes to your mind. If you think of the two episodes we watched, the visual scene that sticks out the most to you. I already sent my screenshot to Shane, so.
The blood on the ground. The blood dripping.
It's the end of that scene for me.
Everyone in bed with Al.
Yes, everyone in bed with Al. The same for me.
Okay. I sent when they're, you know, hovering over him and you see Al's face in the back of the three heads.
Okay,
I thought that was a good capture of what the most important thing was.
You very rarely see this period of medicine played out on TV. I mean, there aren't a lot of shows set in this time period in the first place, but holy shit. Science, yo.
I think that's why Doc's a top five character.
Easy. Yeah, he knows better than anybody else how generally bad at his job he is. It's not his fault. It's just the way it is.
Well, guys, we are hitting the hour 20 mark.
Okay, yeah, let's wrap it up. Thanks for listening, everyone. Visit us at mediocremovie.club. We've got reviews of World of Tomorrow, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Captain America Civil War, Game of Thrones podcast. We got the movie Hush coming up tomorrow. Friday?
Tomorrow or Friday. It'll be one of
the Tomorrow or Friday.
Have you seen it now, John?
No, I need
to. Brian, have you watched it yet?
Yeah, I finished it. It was good. No, not that night before bed. I had to race the next morning. There was no way I was not sleeping through that night.
As you heard on our Game of Thrones one, Kissel's a little weary about it.
I heard, yeah. And so the whole aspect of her being deaf just takes it to another level.
Yeah.
Boy, I better go to the website and read that review.
That's
Friday,
not posted.
Thursday or Friday. Go back and check it out.
So, show up on the weekend. Be there, it'll be there for
today.
Sure.
Or Friday, because you'll hear this on
Thursday. Sure enough. Also, you know, if you're listening to this episode, maybe write us a review on iTunes. Maybe 5 stars. I don't know.
85?
I'd love 85 stars. I mean, that would mean a whole bunch of reviews, more than the 3 we have now. Unless there's been more another one since I last checked. I kind of doubt it. Also on the website, Brian and mine's trip to Eberfest. We wrote along back and forth about that and the movies we saw. So,
yeah, looking forward
solid
to
website.
That.
I like how you say trip when it's like 10 minutes away from Brian.
It was a trip.
It was pretty close.
We'll be back next week with episodes 5 and 6 of the second season entitled Complications, parenthesis, formerly Difficulties, and Something Very Expensive. Another 2 great episodes in season 2. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks
for having me here.
Have a good night.
See ya.